Hello, neighbors. Welcome to Fit to Eat, the Newfoundland Labrador Farm and Food Show. I'm Ivan Emke, your host. This is the show about food and all of the things that go into making it, distributing it, preparing it. Today we talk to a person who's passionate about those creatures that provide us with one of every three mouthfuls of food that we eat. Of course, I'm talking about bees and other pollinators. There aren't many towns in Newfoundland Labrador that get to put the in front of their name and get away with it. The Goulds is one of them. We head there today, one of the breadbaskets of the province. Before dropping in on our guest, I took a few minutes to stop at Bidgood Park, just down the road from his place. This park was dedicated to the farming community in the region. It's one of the few places in the whole province that focuses on the contributions of those who grow our food. It features a sculpture by Gerald Squires. It's called The Mower. It reminded me of the rural romanticism in the art of certain periods of Soviet Russian history. Indeed, it is a man. He's shirtless, with a scythe, accompanied by a quote from Tolstoy, no less. I take a few pictures and head up the road to talk to today's guest. He's a fellow who has an immense passion for what he does. This time, it's a beekeeper, an evangelist for all things apiary.
My name is Paul Dinn, and my wife Brenna and I are the owner and operators of Adelaide's Newfoundland Honey. And we have the only honeybee pollinator and wildflower reserve in the province that I know of right now. So it's 10 acres dedicated to protecting honeybees and pollinators and wildflowers.
But when did you start getting the bug, I suppose, for beekeeping? Bug probably isn't the right metaphor there, but...
It was about 5 years ago. A friend of mine noticed a picture online of us had, we had a lot of fireweed.
Yep.
And he said, you have a lot of fireweed. My dog likes running through it. And I was like, what's fireweed? Because we have a farm here, and I was thinking, is it one of these invasive species? Right. And because it seeds like crazy, you see all the seed going in the fall. So, anyways, I started researching fireweed, and I said, with my mission was, how do I get rid of it? And when I started researching it, it said it's got a nectar that's very high value for beekeepers, and produces one of the most premium honeys in the world. So as soon as that hit me, I said, beekeeping. I said, I wonder if we should try maybe getting a couple hives and experiment with it and see what it's like. We did. And both of us fell in love with it almost day one. And now we'll have anywhere from 60 to 100 colonies by the end of the summer.
So the weed is no longer a weed. It was really a career.
We cherish it now, right?
Yeah.
We cut the grass around them. And they're just starting to bloom right now.
Yeah. What was it about beekeeping that was so attractive, though? That you said from day one, almost you were.
It was it was just the whole combination of your bees are threatened, so you're helping the environment, and we learned about why they're so important for us as to survive, our own survival, how much one third of the world's food is because of bees pollinating the flowers. So we learned about that, so that made it really nice. But you know, simply just sitting down in front of the beehive and watching them coming and going is extremely relaxing, and you can smell the honey and the flowers, and it's just so peaceful, and they work so hard. Like, it's always amazing watching how they don't stop collecting and coming back and going again, and it's got so many aspects, and then watching them grow as well, because when you start off, you have this little nucleus colony, people call them a nuke, and it's five frames of wax and bees, and by the time you build up the colony, it's up to 20 frames, two high big boxes, and then you learn about, you know, how they'll make honey and how they raise their babies and the eggs and the whole bit. And it's super educational. Like, you never stop learning. Every day there's something different happening. And even with the hives themselves, they could be side by side. One is really, really strong and doing great, and the other one is struggling.
You haven't kept this passion to yourself, because you're doing a number of things which spreads it out to other individuals. So you mentioned pollinator services, for example. Explain what that is exactly.
Well, what we do is a bit different. We, with, if someone is interested in learning about beekeeping or pollination services, what we'll do is we do what's called an adopt-a-hive program. So basically, if someone has a strawberry patch or their blueberry growers or apples, what have you, we'll bring hives out there, but we like them to remain on the site. Where a lot of people are into, they'll do pollination services when flowers are blooming.
Yes.
They'll bring them out for maybe a 3-week period and then they'll move them again. We won't do that. We want to keep them in the one spot because transporting them is not really good for the bees. Yeah. It's also an opportunity for them to get get disease. Not that we have very much here in the way of disease, but yeah. If there is an outbreak of something, the last thing you want to be doing is bringing the bees around to spread it. So if someone says, look, I'm growing strawberries and we'll say, all right, we're going to take them, we're going to bring them out there, but we'll leave them there, we'll maintain them, they don't have to do anything with it, mm-hmm. Opposed to they're there for 3 weeks for the bloom and then they're moved back somewhere else, right?
Right, or they're moved to several crops, they're like migrant laborers.
Yeah, because I'll use the California almonds for an example.
Yes, that's a good example.
Yeah. All the beekeepers in the U.S. will bring all their bees down on giant transport trucks, bring them all to the one place for that pollination bloom. But once the almonds are bloomed and they're done, they actually have to get the bees out of there as quick as possible so they don't starve to death. Because they've lost all their flowers. They don't have anything. Mm-hmm. What makes us so lucky here is we have a constant flower bloom coming for over a 6-month period. Mm-hmm. So it starts off like with willows and some different shrubs, then you'll get into your dandelions and clover, and then it goes right on through into the fall when you're going to have goldenrod and fireweed. Mm-hmm. So that having what's very important for us, the message I want to get across, and I tell anyone with agriculture or tourism, whoever, plant your crops, but keep those sections of wildflowers and then biodiversity, because when the bees are pollinating and finished those berries, they can go back to that other. Mm-hmm. That other, but if you have those large miles of monocrops like they do with the California almonds, it's the wrong way to do it. Yeah. We're losing. We're on an island now, and we want to keep our bees healthy. And what's going to keep them healthy is lots of variety of forage, and that's probably one of the biggest things that's happened helping our bees is the fact that they got such a great habitat. And there's so much in the way of diversity and wildflowers and trees and shrubs.
Yeah.
And water too. Like, it's very wet in our area here. The bees have lots of water, they have lots of forage. And if someone says, okay, I'm gonna plant a big strawberry crop, they can still do that, but the bees, once that bloom is done, they can go on to another plant, you know?
This is something that I hear a fair bit, that we are disease-free, and we should be knocking on wood or knocking on beehives. Do you think there's a strong enough resolve to maintain that? Because
it's, you know, it's so interesting. It's like beekeeping really, even now, still doesn't really exist here. It's so new. Mm-hmm. Just to give you an example, Newfoundland only has 600, maybe 700 beehives in total in the whole province, including Labrador, because there are a couple in Goose Bay area. So that is really nothing. Yeah. If you go to PEI, there's 7,000 beehives. Mm. If you go right across the country, it goes up higher and higher and higher. So what's interesting is because it's kind of like an unknown resource here. No one really knows about it. A lot of people have never tasted real honey, and they'll buy their honey from Costco or one of the grocery stores, and they don't realize it's honey, and they don't think too much about it. But now more people are becoming food aware and food conscious of local food, and so it is starting to change. Really, beekeeping here is really non-existent even now.
Even though one of every three spoonfuls of food is at least partly responsible.
But again, we import our food.
We do. Somebody else.
We're only growing 10% here, so that's kind of a weird mixed blessing in a way, as far as the bee side of it, the honeybees, because we haven't grown any large crops and used too much pesticide or anything like that. The bees have lots of natural habitat, and they don't have the pesticides, and they don't have the diseases and mites. Yeah. So we got to find that balance of We don't want people to be bringing in bees or importing used equipment or bees. Yeah. Of even like sometimes they used to bring in bumblebees for mm-hmm. pollination as well, but they also carry the various diseases and, mm-hmm. and pests as well. So we've got a kind of, it's just by fluke, it's just by luck that we got this situation, and how to maintain it, it's difficult to answer that, because really you're in a province where anything can be brought in. If someone wants to bring them in, they can. It's one of these things that people just hopefully will do the right thing.
We have all kinds of species that were introduced in the
exactly.
past. We have a history of that by somebody who says, "Oh, I wish I could hear frogs."
I know.
Yeah. So they bring in frogs.
And shrews were introduced here. Yeah. And shrews are one of the worst things for honeybee hives.
Are they?
They get into a beehive, and because the bees are clustered,
those cute little shrews.
Those little shrews will get in there, and they'll actually eat the honeybees, like grapes, and they eat a lot of them. And we had one beekeeper last year lost 11 hives
to shrews.
Yes. Yep.
When I emailed Paul about an idea for a song, he didn't waste any time in sending a reply. "That's easy," he wrote. "Here's something close to my heart." This is Blake Shelton with the song Honeybee.
Thinking about us, and you know I ain't good at this stuff, but these feelings piling up won't give me no rest. This might come out a little crazy, a little sideways, yeah maybe. I don't know how long it'll take me, but I'll do my best. You be my soft and sweet, I'll be your strong and steady. You be my glass of wine, I'll be your shot of whiskey. You be my sunny day, shade tree. You be my honeysuckle, I'll be your honeybee. Yeah, that came out a little country, but every word was right on the money, and I got you smiling, honey, right back at me. Now hold on, 'cause I ain't done, there's more where that came from. Well, you know I'm just having fun, but seriously. You be my Louisiana, I'll be your Mississippi. You be my little Loretta, I'll be your Conway Twitty. You be my sugar baby, I'll be your sweet iced tea. You be my honeysuckle, I'll be your honeybee.
I'm speaking with Paul Dinn of Adelaide's Honeybee Pollinator and Wildflower Reserve. He starts off the segment by telling us about an agritourism initiative that they've begun at their location.
Another big thing you do is, you're keen on education, and you have tours as well. Tell me a bit about where that came from and what that is.
Well, we do what's called the Honeybee Hike, and what it is we're in a bit of a unique situation. So we were over the years, since actually 1989, I've been preparing a walking trail through our property with the idea, we were thinking at the time, we might do glamping, right?
Oh, nice.
High-end camping,
yes.
Glamping. and or something along that lines. So then when the honeybees came on scene, people were interested, and we had a lot of people saying, look, I really like to come and see them. When we started talking about the Adopt-A-Hive out there, and people were saying, well, I really don't want to adopt one, but I'd love to come and see yours. Then it said, well, why don't we do a honeybee hike? And then people could come here 3 times a week, book in advance and set it all up, and they'll learn a bit about beekeeping. And if they're interested in getting into beekeeping, it's inexpensive. We'll charge like $48 for an adult, $20 for children, that includes tax. And then what they'll do is they'll get to actually go on a hike and see what the bees are foraging at that time, then come back to a beehive. And we have a lot of different beehives, so we're changing out which one we're going to inspect on whatever particular day. We'll open up the beehive, we'll show them how we perform an inspection, and they'll actually get to hold a frame of bees, maybe with 1,000+ bees on it. And they'll also get to taste honey right directly out of the beehive. And it's it's been doing really well. People, no one has spit out the honey yet, not one person. but people are really enjoying it.
Yeah.
They are, and tourism came in, Department of Tourism now. You have to go through a quality program now where they actually inspect and want to see what you're doing. And they loved it. They promoted us. We're on the tourism website, and I can see it growing and growing. But no matter how much it how popular it gets, because we're a reserve, we'll only take 3 days a week.
Yeah.
It will never become a daily thing, because we want the bees to be like they are now. They're all in a very natural habitat. They're stressless. They don't have any stress.
Yeah.
We do what's called low impact beekeeping. So if you go to some commercial beekeepers, you'll see it could be up 100 to 200 hives all in one area.
Mm-hmm.
They go to, and that's for the convenience of the beekeeper. So what happens is the beekeeper can work each hive and go from one to one, collecting the honey. Ours are done so that it's the benefit of the bees. As people are walking through the trail, there'll be a couple of hives here, then there'll be a couple of hives down further. We won't put too many beehives here as well, because we don't want them working against the native pollinators for forage. So if there's wildflowers here, we want them to be just enough honeybees that they're not forcing the native pollinators to go elsewhere. Mm-hmm. They keep them here as well. Mm-hmm. So what's great, Julie Circum, you might know at the university, we brought her, we sent her a few pictures and videos of the honeybees actually right alongside on the same flowers with native pollinators. And she said, you just destroyed a myth.
Because
pollinators, natural pollinators and honeybees are not supposed to get along together, but she said, you're just showing what they do.
Do you find when people leave the tour, like, does it affect their whole view of food in general, not just honey?
They do. They become more appreciative of the fact that, you know, because we've seen them on the wild raspberries and strawberries pollinating everything, and I'll explain how that's working, and children especially are amazed.
So what about honey in other products? Or I know you've explored a little bit about that.
Yeah.
What sort of things have you done?
It's, beeswax will, people will, because there's not a lot of production here, people will import beeswax. But if it's not being used in a beehive, that's fine. And honey, like honey coming in, you'd never want to feed honey from outside your own apiary, your own bees, to your bees.
Mm-hmm.
And you never want to use wax brought in from anywhere, because it will have all those diseases and everything else in there, right? So, but sometimes, I guess my fear is that someone innocently would not know that and just do it.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently, I don't know if it was PEI or what happened, but someone brought in hives from Ontario or somewhere moving to PEI, not really thinking about it, and then they lost their health status because they brought the disease in with them, right?
Yeah.
So things like that, it's a hard one to, you can put all kinds of regulations in there, but how's it going to be regulated? Who's going to, it's more just getting the word out to people and say, you know, don't do this, try not to, you know, and I think once people know that they shouldn't import or wax or whatever.
Kiss just said it all. I'm glad we had this talk. Nothing left to do but fall in each other's arms. I could have said I love you, could have wrote you a line or two. Baby, all I know to do is speak right from the heart. You'll be my soft and sweet, I'll be your strong and steady. You'll be my glass of wine, I'll be your shot of whiskey. You'll be my sunny day,
Today on Fit to Eat, I'm speaking with beekeeper Paul Dinn of Adelaide's Honeybee Pollinator and Wildflower Reserve. Next up, we talk about how the way that we clear land can have an impact on bee and pollinator health, and over time, on crop health itself. Beware the large open field.
I tell you what's interesting. If you go and look at the rest of the country, say Saskatchewan or Alberta, and you look at the farmland, and they've got these massive hay fields that just go on forever. But what they haven't done is they have they when they make a new field, they'll put hedgerows. The hedgerows are on the sides there, or windrows. Mm-hmm. They've pushed all the wildflowers up onto the side. If they were to leave those, because if you go with Scotland, in Scotland, those hedgerows are protected. Mm-hmm. They're, mm-hmm. The farmers actually are paid to look after them. Mm-hmm. Here, our farmers are paid to remove them.
Right.
And when you remove those hedgerows, you're taking all that biodiversity, all the wildflowers, all those wild bushes, everything is gone. They'll screen the topsoil and they'll just burn whatever is left after. Mm-hmm. And you're making a larger and larger field. But keeping those windrows in between, and those little sanctuaries for bees and for pollinators and for birds, those are what's going to make the difference in this province, mm-hmm. of us being very sustainable agriculture compared to losing everything, because we don't want just big long grasslands.
It's interesting because and we've seen a number of fields, including ones that are being developed, that are just hacked out of the wilderness. And it's a whole different look than agriculture in many other provinces. But you're saying there's a real advantage to the fact that we have small fields in the midst of all kinds of bush because it maintains those pollinators.
Yeah. Well, if you went back to my grandfather's time, what they used to do with the topsoil, because they didn't have the heavy equipment, even, go back to my great-grandfathers, they would have horses, and they would pull the stumps out, and they would leave the topsoil there. But now it's so easy to take the heavy equipment and just push everything to the side. So when they push everything to the side, it's all a large, we call them windrows or hedgerows, leave those there. Because that has everything in it that the bees will need. All your fireweed, all your goldenrod is right there, and your hayfield is in the middle. One thing we've noticed since we've brought bees here is not only we have more flowers and berries for the birds, but the bees actually will consume the bees themselves. The birds will actually go after the bees themselves, because each colony loses about 500 bees a day, which sounds like a lot, but queen is laying 2,000 eggs a day. The hive has got 40 to 50,000 in it, so they'll lose 500 a day. But those 500 bees that are crawling out of there, and what they usually walk away or fly away from the hive, the birds are picking them up. The ones that they don't get are going back into the soil, and they're enriching the soil. So we've noticed here a complete change in our whole environment with regards for breeding the bees. We have so many songbirds here now. Mm-hmm. It's incredible. You see them all. It's almost like we just invited them because they're here because the bees are there, right? Yeah.
I'm amazed at how quickly this argument that don't cut your dandelions right away has caught on. I think it's because none of us really care to mow the grass every 3 days or whatever it is. But it's kind of interesting. And they're doing it because of the bees. And so people authentically keep it longer. So changes can happen fairly quickly.
It's interesting, you know, when you think about it. We have almost been brainwashed, mm-hmm. that our lawn has to be this
green
flowing lawn. And you know something? Yeah. It does look nice. Don't get me wrong. When you see that lawn, like everybody's trying to get that golf course green lawn. But then when you realize that, hey, there's no nutrition whatsoever for any animal. There's nothing in it. Well, why not have a few patches of flowers and what different things? And people are getting more into these wild garden type lawns now, where you can go out and you see all the diversity of different flowers, and it's beautiful. Yeah.
You mentioned this is a retirement project, and we talk a lot about trying to get new entrants into agriculture of various kinds, but there's also the second career farmer, apiculturist and so on. Some of the beekeepers that you know, is that a real phenomenon? Is there, should we be going after more people who are retiring early, who still have energy to get into agriculture?
I think it's the more the merrier. Like, just think about it. You've been working all your life. You probably did a little bit of gardening on the side because you only had time to have a small patch of vegetables. Mm-hmm. And I mean, all of our parents used to grow a lot of their own vegetables and everything else. So it's in us to grow our own vegetables and grow a few things, and we enjoy it. Now you've got more time as you're retiring, so you can grow a little bigger, you can diversify it, you can do a little bit of beekeeping. It's not like you're just going to retire and go lay on the beach. If you're used to working all the time, you're going to all of a sudden be off for a little while, and you're going to say, okay, what do I do now? And I know so many people that retire And they were just like, okay, I took another part-time job because I needed something to do. I was getting bored. So agriculture is a perfect fit.
It is ironic. There's two discussions. Some people say nothing grows here. It's a rock. The same thing, you look around and it's totally covered with vegetation. Yeah. And even in the little crevices of the rock, there are plants starting to grow. So it's not that, it's just the things that we want to grow.
Yes.
Maybe don't grow here, but it's certainly.
And I think it's, look at our ancestors. I mean, they came here. And they all had farms. They all grew their own food. They did it. And they didn't rely on someone bringing it in. They always grew their own. They always made the soil. They would bring seaweed and kelp and everything else. And they used capelin in the garden and everything else to enrich it. And they always grew their own foods. Mm-hmm. We've done it for 500 years.
Yeah. This is a dumb question. I kind of know how you'll answer it. But if you were to give somebody local food, a feed of local food, what would be included in that?
Included in local food? Oh, yeah. Boy. I love Jake. Like, I do love Jake's dinner and traditional meals. But our cod is delicious.
Yeah.
Fresh cod. But I'm a big fan of, I think a Jake's dinner is a good meal for me with all our different vegetables and locally cooked.
Here I thought you'd have sort of honey as the prime.
Well, for dessert you can a bit of chocolate ice cream with fireweed honey on it.
Fireweed honey. Yeah. What's your favorite way to eat honey?
Well, I do like it on ice cream.
So this is a Sunday, and you're taking a bit of a break because you have people coming by asking questions. But on an average day, like tomorrow, what do you have to do? What does a beekeeper do?
We have to, tomorrow we're actually putting honey supers on, additional honey boxes. So they're filling the lower box, and what we do is called bottom supering. So what happens is you'll lift the box that's on there off. So there's the colony, which is two boxes, and that has the queen and the babies and everything else. And then there's like a queen excluder, and what that looks like, it's like a barbecue grate. It's just a screen where the other bees can get through, but the queen can't. So what happens is she can't get up to lay any eggs in where the honey super is, because people don't want baby bees or eggs in their honey, right? So what happens is the bees will get up there and they'll store honey, and then once that box gets filled, we'll take it off and we'll put another box in its place and put that original one that has honey above it, and then the bees will really, because they want the honey as close to the brood nest as possible, so then they'll fill that one.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
And it just continues as these boxes, as by the fall, you'll start off with two boxes, and you might have seven by the end of the season. We average about 70 pounds of honey per hive. We're only taking surplus honey.
Yes.
That's the other thing, is you want to leave a good 90-100 pounds of honey for the bees. And a lot of mistake that new beekeepers make is they might take too much at the beginning. The bees don't have enough to get through to our spring, and they'll starve.
For people who are still, you know, frightened of bees, or what advice do you have to people around bees?
You'll never see a bee fall. Like honeybees are just interested in the flowers, and they're going to that particular flower and then back to the hive. And when you're at a picnic or you're walking through the woods and all of a sudden you see this thing flying around in your face or something stings you, it's a wasp. Or it's a hornet. Mm-hmm. It's not a honeybee. Honeybees will never get up in your face and kind of look like they're following you. People don't realize honeybees only eat pollen and nectar. That's their food source. Where a wasp will eat, they'll eat meat. They'll eat baby bees, they'll eat the eggs, they'll eat other insects. And so wasps are going after your picnic and they're following you around and everything else.
Paul, thanks so much for taking the time.
You're welcome.
That's great, and all the best in your various experiments and activities here.
Thanks. Okay. We'll show you the bees now.
Okay, excellent.
And we did see the bees and the fireweed and the wildflowers. As I watched the activity, the organization, the industry around me, I thought of that statistic that one mouthful in every three was a result of the work of these creatures and other native pollinators. Maybe there should be a big statue of a bee somewhere in a park devoted to pollinators, a park with biologically diverse windrows, of course. This has been Fit to Eat, the Newfoundland Labrador Farm and Food Show. If you have questions or comments, email me at fittoeatnl, one word, at gmail.com. To listen to other episodes or for more information, go to www.fittoeatnl.ca. The music for today's show was Honeybee by Blake Shelton. The theme music, Cluck Old Hen, was done this week by Ross Nickerson. This is a production of Kitchen Table Communications with the support of the Newfoundland Labrador Federation of Agriculture and Food First NL. I'm Ivan Emke. Happy trails.
Look at our ancestors. I mean, they came here and they all had fern. They all grew their own food. They always made the soil. They would bring seaweed and kelp and everything else, and they used capelin in the garden and everything else to enrich it. And they always grew their own foods. Mm-hmm. We've done it for 500 years.